Coming up on today's show...
And definitely, I've totally ignored the Nick Jonas component. Nick was so gracious to hop on it and, of course, has an incredible cultural connection to India through his wife. And so he was just, like, such an exciting... We were so happy when we got him. I remember, like, we were like, yeah! If you want something to play with, get a guitar. No one in it can that'll make it, just keep up. 발박자를 맞추고, 손은 stepping like 1, 2, 5. 모두 집중해줘, and now better guitar. Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Remember, too, about the other free option for interaction with this show that I've been mentioning the last few weeks, Featured Up, which you can find a link to in this episode's description. If you want something to play with, get a guitar. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Los Angeles, my guest is a producer, songwriter, artist, and engineer who has worked on Grammy-nominated and platinum projects with a long list of artists including Nick Jonas, Bella Porch, Benson Boone, Gucci Mane, Salem Elise, and several others. He has been written about in major music media such as Billboard and Rolling Stone. Last year, there were more than 233 million streams on Spotify alone of songs that he wrote. You've been hearing a song he worked on called Get a Guitar by Rise. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, David Arkwright.
Hey, Bruce. Hello, everybody. What an intro. Come on.
Thank you so much for taking time out to talk with me today.
Oh, happy to.
Folks, the song that was just playing during the intro is by Rise, who, oh, by the way, set the record for the fastest K-pop group to hit 1 million followers on Instagram just 4 days after their account was launched. And the selection from their catalog that was just playing, wow, it has almost 67 million streams on Spotify alone. David, tell us about that track, Get a Guitar, and your role in it, including how that came to be, how you got to work with Rise.
Certainly, yeah, absolutely. So the track was written maybe a year earlier, prior to any of the collaborators' knowledge regarding the group itself and that sort of thing. I had written it with myself, another writer named Ben Samama, and then a production duo named PhD, Daniel and Peter. They're both Danish, and unfortunately I can't equitably pronounce their last names. But they are, you know, wonderful collaborators, and we work together a lot of the time. And basically, we had actually just written the track. It was the first time the four of us had ever worked together, and it was amid COVID, I think. Mm. And it was an over Zoom sort of, or like, you know, Zoom Skype kind of video situation.
Okay.
And we wrote that song really just to write it, just to, you know, it was often with collaborators, you'll find it's like in the first sort of meeting, it's kind of just like feeling each other out. And that was, you know, generally speaking, exactly what was happening there is we were just trying to figure out like what are our musical tastes, that sort of thing. So we just wrote a song to write a song. That was our first discovery that that particular group of people actually has a really great chemistry, and we've written together a lot since, and we have more songs coming out with other artists and, mm-hmm. and more with Rise and stuff like that. Ben had walked into the room, and he had this idea for, if you want something to play with, get a guitar. And then I had some idea about the don't, don't, don't. And it just sort of slowly, it was one of those very collaborative, it just kind of pieced itself together. And the gentleman and PhD are just two of the funkiest humans of all time. Like, they're just incredible, incredible players. So then if we fast forward, we were sitting on that record for about a year, and there was a fair amount of interest from different groups and people. Mm. And then Rise sort of came on our radar as this new, very exciting, you know, upstart K-pop group, and the gentleman and PhD work a lot in K-pop. And so we decided to basically just take a chance on it. You know, we had some more established groups that were looking for the song, but there was just something really exciting about what they were trying to do and how the label described the project to us. And yeah, I think you put it super well, is like it went from, you know, no Instagram to a million followers to no one's ever heard the song to, I think it was like 2 million physical sales. Wow. In between Korea and Japan. So wow. I might be misquoting that number exactly, but it's definitely in the millions. So yeah, no, it was as shocking to us as it is to anyone who is sort of watching the trajectory of the project.
But this is one of those instances where I will often say, if this was a video podcast, at the bottom of the screen, it would be flashing results not typical, because
yeah.
You described for us a situation that enough songwriters have lived through, which is meeting some other collaborators for the first time, and you're really just getting in the room together to see what the vibe is, how you gel together, or maybe how you don't gel together. And you came out with this song. Okay, great. It seems like we probably have a thing here. We're going to work together nicely. But you don't really think that first song is going to turn into what Get a Guitar turned into. And so
no.
How, David, yeah. How do you go from that mindset walking into an initial write, I'm going to see who these guys are and how we do, how do you go from that mindset to, oh, wait a minute, this is actually a really good song that we need to shop this?
Yeah, so I think oftentimes there is sort of a bit of a catalytic moment early in the writing process. I often describe this to other friends who have had, you know, escalatingly bigger records, and I think the uniform consensus is that the most exciting part time of writing a song, even bigger than like it doing millions of copies or platinum records or, you know, Billboard, whatever, is always the moment after you write it. There is this really electric feeling of sort of what could be. And it's also, there's this element of like creating something from nothing. And so I think we knew the day of that we all had something that we liked. I think it's often very difficult, you know, if I recount records over the course of my career, I think it's often very difficult to know, you know, I think you can be like, hey, this is a good song. I think it's often difficult to then take that and go, this is going to be a great song,
right?
Or this is going to be a big record for this artist, because so much of it is, of course, out of your hands. It's, you know, what's happening in the world at any given day, what's happening with this artist, does the record executive that heard it, did they have a nice breakfast, did they get in a fight with their spouse in the morning, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's things way beyond the scope of your control when you're shopping records, but I think we all immediately knew that it was special. And usually I'd say the typical process for something like that is kind of shortly after we're finished with it, we all go, hey, we should send this out immediately, and we start to ping off ideas of, you know, I remember with that record, it was like, oh, maybe it could be DNCE, it could be, you know, Måneskin, it could be like a couple of different like groups. And then it's just about finding, you know, at that point, it's, we know we have something special. Now it's about finding the home for the artist that is in that place for that record. Because as much as maybe, you know, and this is not a good example with this record, but it's, you know, you could write a song and go, hey, this is perfect for Justin Bieber. But if Justin Bieber isn't in that place musically, then it's not going to hold a lot of weight in that respect. So,
but I'm glad that you described all that, because let's face it, there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of songwriters who finish a song and they think it's something special. And so was the last one they wrote. And so was the one 2 months ago. And they all use that same term, which I'm sorry, I'm going to say it. I'm so over people using the expression, we wrote a real banger today.
Yeah.
I mean, who gets on social media and says, we wrote a song today that was mediocre, but at least we got one done.
Yeah.
But so I'm glad you walked us through. These are kind of the ways that you can identify that, no, you know what? This one really is, in fact, special. I know they all should be, and they're your children, et cetera, et cetera. But this is how you differentiate the ones where you go, hey, this is a really good song, versus the ones where you look at each other and go, hey, we got something here.
Yeah, and I also think often it's like a little bit of perspective is massively your friend. And it's interesting how, like, songs shift over the scope of time. So it's, I've had records where I go, the day of, I go, this is, you know, a bang or a smash or whatever. And then a week later, I go, ooh, I don't think we really hit that one. Mm. And then a year later, I'll come back to it and I'll go, wow, we might have actually been like ahead of our time a little, you know what I mean? Like, because songs exist in the context of, I think it's important to remind a younger songwriter, songs exist in the context of the world around it. Like, a great example of that is what's been happening on TikTok, as you see, like, Taylor Swift's Cruel Summer came out 2 years before it was the hit that it is today. And it's just because the world either wasn't ready for it, or the moment wasn't right, or whatever. It's the longevity of a copyright, and however you know, in whatever scale that comes, can change. So I think I more like to act on the side of not ambivalence precisely, but just like a general unknowingness of, hey, like, I have a good sense of what's good and what's not good, but I also could be really wrong and I could be really right. And I try and just go, okay, like anything's possible. Don't write off anything. But also you still have to like listen to your instincts that day, that week, that month of what you think is good. And that's the whole thing of just making art.
Nicely said. We're off to a great start. And David, as much as there are going to be friends of yours, colleagues, followers coming to this episode of Narrow This Entertainment, and by the way, to those folks I say hello, welcome. I hope you'll check out some other episodes of the show. Over my 10 plus years of doing this show every week, I have been fortunate to get listeners from 165 countries around the world, which means there are going to be people just being introduced to you for the first time. Tell us about your early career in music.
Certainly. I was born February 20th. I really, you know, it's sort of, I think like 3 or 4 years old, I had expressed to my parents that I wanted to play the drums. And subsequently, I have an older and a younger brother, 3 years in each direction. And my older brother actually ended up playing the drums for, you know, sort of school bands, that kind of thing before me, and was actually quite proficient. And so he sort of carved this real... I lived in a very small town, so I grew up in a place called Wasaga Beach, Ontario, Canada. And so that was, you know, a town of, at the time, I think was like 13,000, is maybe now 21,000. Like, it's still very small. And so his sort of namesake of being really good at the drums kind of carved this interesting path for me all the way through high school, where my interest in playing the drums was then sort of... I got really lucky because people would give me a bit of a look at schools and that sort of thing. And so from a really young age, I had an interest in sort of music generally. Like, it just always spoke to me. And I had, you know, I wouldn't say an abnormally natural proclivity for it, like not like a, you know, a Charlie Puth or a John Mayer where it's you sit down and it's just we don't have the video on, but if you could see it, this, like, you know, majesty of playing. I had none of that, but I just had a lot of interest in it and a focus towards it. And so that was my sort of early life. And my dad had wanted to be, he's like many fathers will exclaim, to be the world's largest Beatles fan. And I promise you my father is. And he had wanted to be in a band for most of his life. And it just, you know, because of life circumstances or whatever, it never quite worked out for him. But the second me and my brothers had sort of expressed an interest in music, he kind of tripled down. So it's like, you want a drum kit? I bought you a drum kit. Go down, play in the basement, make as much noise as you want. So I always had this really, really good fostered relationship with music very early on. And then on my journey, I had decided in high school I want to be a jazz percussionist, which sort of meant, you know, like jazz drums, or not exactly jazz, but I want to be a session drummer. And in order to get into a school called Humber College, which is like Canada's equivalent of Berkeley, if you will, I had to learn how to rudimentarily play the piano and sing. And that was just like, you know, a general proficiency for harmony purposes. And in doing so, so I'm about 18, 19, I joined the high school choir in my last year of high school, having never sung a note in my entire life. And I buy this used piano off of my then girlfriend's, like, dad's girlfriend, or, you know what I mean? Like, some loose acquaintance. I get this old beat up piano that I still have and still has a lot of magic in my parents' home in Canada. And then all of a sudden I had all the tools to write songs, and I kind of didn't realize it. So it's like, you know, I started in choir and all of a sudden I realized, like, oh no, I actually can sing with reasonable proficiency. Like, sure. I was kind of better than, you know, not to be uncouth, but like I was performing a little better than the other guys in the group there, you know, and like slowly learning how the piano worked and sort of generalized harmony. And then by the time I got to college and I had started, all of a sudden I found myself in the practice rooms of the school on the piano writing songs way more than I was practicing the drums. And so I sort of recognized really early that, you know, as soon as you start writing your first songs, you have, it's just this electric, like, to, and even still to this day, it's like, you know, I spend a lot of my time as a producer in a lot of ways, but the writing of a song to me is by far the most passionate part of the process. And I don't think that's ever going to get old. And so in sort of learning to do that, I realized, you know what, maybe school isn't the right way for me. So I dropped out. And I had, amidst this, I had been in sort of like a high school band playing the drums. And then I started to take a more active role in that band for writing songs and still drumming, but, you know, being a larger part of the musical sort of expression of the band rather than just the guy sitting at the back keeping time. We were called Trainlight, and we toured the country a little bit in Canada. Nothing terribly extensive or super exciting, but it definitely, like, opened me up into sort of, like, the smallest version of the rock stardom kind of world. You know, you play some stages that were cool, and we had some good shows and that sort of thing. And then from there, I'd realized, you know, actually, I'm more passionate about being an artist at the time. And so I started to release pop music myself as a solo artist. And that kind of then transitioned into trying to make my way through that, which, of course, as anyone can attest, is very difficult, especially, you know, before the world of TikTok, where there was no social media outlet piping your stuff directly to somebody, so long as you're putting it out there. And sort of in the mad scramble to do that, I, at one point, there's another incredible producer in Canada named Mike Wise. And he's a very good friend of mine, and we work together a lot now. And he had produced my first sort of solo EP as an artist. And I had, you will not believe this, it's crazy, but I had been on Craigslist, and there was an ad on Craigslist. I'm dead serious. So it's like, I'm this artist struggling, trying to, I just want to like make music. I don't really know what that entails. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not ready to tour or anything. And there's this ad on Craigslist to like write, hey, like, can you write songs for other people? Mm. Like, is that a thing, you know, that sort of thing. And I don't know why I answered, but I did. And I sent through that EP of songs I'd made. And on the other end of that EP was sort of like a loose connection to what would become the band Magic. So at the time they were the Messengers, which were like a duo that had done like Justin Bieber, Chris Brown, like all of this stuff. And so it was like a real industry connection, like setting up. And like they set me up with a session with there's this Canadian artist named George Nazuka, who at the time was pretty big in Canada. And like all of a sudden I went from this Craigslist ad to like, oh, no, this is a legitimate.
Crazy.
Like, kind of like in a ludicrous fashion. Like, none of that makes sense at all. Looking back on it, I'm like, that is objectively the wrong thing for anyone to do, and do not follow in my footsteps. But it just, you know, they were trying to like figure out, how do we connect with young songwriters in Toronto, where there isn't the same kind of industry that there is in Los Angeles and that sort of thing, or at least there wasn't at the time. And so that's how I sort of was inducted into session world.
Okay.
And then this was all around the emergence of dance music. So now we're getting into like, I haven't given years loosely on this, but this is, you know, around like now 2011, 2012, the emergence of like dance music as this really popular, sort of took over the world for a good 3-4 years there. And so I started thinking, okay, how can I work with DJs? Because that's the new popular thing. And I messaged a DJ that another friend of mine had worked with, and he had liked my voice. Like, I sent him, you know, like, hey, here's some songs I've done. And he said, hey, we should do a song together. And his manager at the time, his name was Ben, and Ben reached out to me and he goes, hey, I really like your voice. Like, do you have management? And I said, no, I don't have management. Like, I don't know anybody. I don't know what I'm doing. And so he's like, hey, do you think I could manage you? And like, we'll try and send your stuff around. I'm like, sure, sounds good. And within 6 months, Ben was really well connected to Avicii and Avicii's manager. And so then we sent them some songs, and they loved what we were doing. And so I ended up signing it's a group called PRMD, which is sort of a venture with Avicii, Avicii's manager, and a bunch of other people, label and publisher out of Stockholm. And so that was my first publishing deal.
Crazy.
And it just sort of all happened really, you know, if there was a moral to be taken from the story, is just sort of like, you know, shooting your shot a little bit sometimes in the moment seems like there's no connective tissue at all. And now looking back at it, I can really connect like the obvious actions to threads of moments of when that all happened.
Sure.
Anyways, long story, very long. I am with that group for a while. Of course, Avicii passed away. And this was around sort of the same time that I had, you know, I had been focused on dance music and had realized like, no, I really had a passion for pop writing. And that was sort of like, you know, as many things do in life, you follow where the fire is. And I had followed this sort of like, you know, I got a pub deal. I was in with some of the biggest dance people in the world. Like, maybe I should be doing dance. And after a time I had realized like, no, I really want to be focused on pop. And that's sort of entering up to the moment where I'm starting to travel to Los Angeles to try and book, you know, help my publisher at the time, helping me like book trips into Los Angeles and like starting to meet a couple people there, you know, going for a week at a time and then 2 weeks at a time. And then at one point I went for a month, and that was sort of a moment where I realized, okay, now maybe it's time to make the move.
I see. And that was what year?
I moved there, and eventually I had moved there, and I think it was the end of 2017.
Okay. Okay. Just let's have a little fun. I got to back up here because
please.
One thing that you don't know about me yet is even though I'm going on close to 24 years that I've lived in Florida, I had spent my entire life living in Western New York. And because I worked in the National Hockey League for 10 seasons, because I worked in pro indoor lacrosse, I was made an honorary Canadian citizen. I'm holding up quotation marks. I'm saying that kind of kidding, kind of kiddingly. But so, you know, I would go over the bridge to Fort Erie. I would go, say, to Niagara-on-the-Lake. I would go to Toronto. I'd go to Hamilton. You know, I know things like the QEW, the Don Valley Parkway, the Gardner Expressway. And so people could mention cities like Timmins and Etobicoke and Mississauga, and I know these. But you hit upon one that I went, okay, he's got me there. I've never heard of Wasaga Beach.
Wasaga Beach or Wasaga Beach,
yeah. So not only am I going to ask you where that is, but keep in mind, there's going to be people listening in Arizona. There's going to be people listening in Sweden. So I guess they're going to want to know, just tell me how close it is to Toronto.
Super fair, yeah. So it's an hour and a half north of Toronto, so about 130 kilometers north of Toronto. And it is, I would describe it as Canada's Jersey Shore, if that makes sense. So it is a town of, again, now about 21,000, but it will see visitors of, on, say, like a long weekend, like a really hot long weekend, because it's the world's largest freshwater beach. So it's 5 kilometers of freshwater beach.
Wow.
And so it will see visitors of up to 500,000 people over the course of just a weekend. Yeah, so it would go from like a town that you could drive end to end in 11 minutes to it would take you 2.5 hours to, you know, get to the grocery store. Like, it was crazy.
Oh, my gosh. So in other words, it prepared you for life in Los Angeles.
Yeah, super. There is a lot of reminiscent sort of nature between those two. It's like I find the parallels all the time, especially in sort of like, there's kind of like a beach summer sense memory sort of thing where I get like flashbacks to me working at, you know, like as a 16-year-old at some like beach hut stand, and I have a panic attack. And anyways,
in the intro, I mentioned just some of the many artists you've worked with. And one of them I had said was Bella Poarch. Her song Build a Bitch tallied over 1 billion global streams since exploding to number one on the YouTube video charts, which marked the biggest debut ever for a new artist. And if all that wasn't enough, the song was certified platinum. Congratulations, David. You co-wrote Build a Bitch. Tell us all about working on that track.
Yeah, certainly. So that track was written with myself, obviously, my friend Salem Elise, who's an incredible artist that, you know, I work with a lot still, and my friend and very close collaborator, Justin Gamella. And so we had started the track originally, and Salem had come again. Interestingly, this was, I think, my second COVID Zoom session.
Mm.
So interestingly, it's like, for whatever reason, I had a really good run on Zoom for COVID. So it's like my first session was Sideways by Elenium. The second one was this Bella Poarch song. And then I'm sure like a period of doing nothing. But anyways, Salem had come into the session with this idea of writing Build a Bitch. And she is this incredible concept genius. And then, you know, after sort of meandering for a little while, as a joke, I had said, "This ain't Build a Bitch." And it was literally like kidding. And then emerged sort of the song. Like, we all just sort of went, oh, wait, maybe there's something there. And then, you know, Justin started playing. Justin is this incredible chordsmith, this, like, genius on the piano. And he started playing something in harmonic minor. And it went through a couple, you know, quick iterations the day of. But it was one of those songs that between the three of us, it just flowed out sort of immediately. Like, there was zero resistance. There was zero need to say no. There was zero, like, almost no edits, like exactly the way you hear it is virtually the way that it emerged, with the exception of some production changes that came down the line. And yeah, it was just like one of those really, you know, special things where it was just like, it happened super quickly from the beginning. I think we had started another idea in the beginning of the session and then pivoted at a certain point.
Mm.
But yeah, it was just like this incredible rocket ship of a writing process. And then we sat on it for a while, to be honest. Like, Justin and I were busy, and we had a couple, you know, a bunch of different things to work on. And then eventually we sort of were like, hey, we've been meaning to get back to, like, produce out the demo of this song.
Mm.
And so finally, you know, I think it was like 6 months later, honestly. It's like after 6 months, it's like many things in music, you just get like
stuck with the thing that's in front of you, and we had had another project to finish something, and we came back and went, whoa, this is amazing. And so we finished up the demo version of the production and then sent it to Salem and her team. And her manager was just very good friends with the Bella Porch team and knew that they were had a project emerging, and they had sent it over, and that was pretty much it. It was just, you know, there's a couple other changes that occurred from there on, you know, production-wise, like a couple small writing things, but generally speaking, it's like that's about the process.
Okay, but, and maybe the answer to this is, well, Bruce, let's get you Salem Elise as a guest on your show, and you can ask her that yourself. But when
I'm
you
sure
said that
to.
She came to it and she kind of had the idea, and
yeah.
Let's face it, she's an extremely accomplished artist. So
yes.
There, the three of you were putting the song together, and right when you started to say, we put it to the side, we, for whatever reason, sat on it for 6 months, my mind went to, well, why wasn't this song just completed and given to Salem for her to record? And or why did she not speak up? Why was this song in a position to be shopped to Bella as opposed to Salem? And like I said, maybe
Certainly.
This is a question for her, but, you know, I'm hearing someone of her caliber, someone of her stature as an artist being involved in this and thinking, what happened?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think, you know, Salem, my relationship with Salem is such that it's like we do a lot of writing for her. We do a lot of writing for other people. So it's sort of this. Every day we sort of get, you know, whenever we get together, it's always a very similar process, which is like, hey, let's just make a song that we both like and are inspired by and think
mm-hmm.
is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to worry about, you know, is it for you? Is it for somebody else? Is it even good later?
Like,
I see. All of that is a very afterthought.
I see.
And in respect of sort of Salem's, I think, like, we had sent over the song and basically, like, her, obviously her team loved it, but didn't feel like at the moment for her it was the right thing relative to, you know, because this is the thing about artists is that it's like they have a lot going on. They have a lot of, you know, it's not just limited to even just the music. It could be brands. It could be,
sure.
But even if we look at the music, it could be, hey, you've got your next six releases and maybe this doesn't really fit in the scope of that release It's now been so long I don't remember the specific reason.
Yeah.
And obviously it's like if Salem had wanted the record, it's like she would have had first right of refusal to take it because she was, you know, an early collaborator,
yeah.
and it's like as much her record as it is anybody's. And so if she'd wanted it, we would have given it to her. But I think it just at the time didn't make sense for her, for whatever was there. And, you know, I've talked to her about it since, interestingly, and it's like we both agree that there was also just this magic with it going to Bella Porch, with what was happening with her sort of in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit of a shock factor that I think was also, you know, I have to be honest with myself and with, you know, it's a great song, but I also think part of it was her as a first release coming out with this song that I think people didn't expect. It didn't really sound like anything else in the moment.
Yeah.
And no one had a sense of what her sound was. And so there was no expectation, positive or negative. And so when it hit the world, I think people were just really, you know, the uniform reaction that I got from people both within the industry and without is like, whoa, like I was not expecting that. And it was very exciting because of that.
Yeah, well
so
placed.
I think there, yeah, exactly. It was just, you know, it's magical A&R move. And so it's the case that I have no regrets about it one way or the other. You know, if Salem had wanted it, I'm sure it could have lived an equally big but just different life.
Yeah.
But I'm also happy that it went to Bella and that that made sense.
There's a great lesson in there, though, that you gave out that I want to go back and repeat, because if anyone listening is an aspiring artist yourself or an aspiring songwriter, I want to say aspiring songwriter, the lesson, David, that I want to make sure that we highlight is that you said that you and Salem go into co-write saying, let's just write a good song, period, and worry later about who's going to record it. Or did we write it for you? Because I think what you're describing is, if you're a writer and you're in a session and you start thinking, oh, I like this song, I think that I should do this, I should cut this. Well, now all of a sudden you're not focused on making sure you finish out with a good song. Now you're saying,
yes,
when do I speak up? And could, when would be the right time for it? And you're getting so far ahead of the game that you're losing focus on, hold on, we're trying to get a good bridge right now. You know, the other writers in the room don't know that that's what's going on with you mentally, but I think that's a great lesson for aspiring songwriters to hear, that the focus is, let's just get a good song done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there are certain caveats to that that exist, which is, I think having an aim for the day is also, you know,
the last thing I also want is to be working, you know, have an artist come in and have us go like, well, maybe it's for you and maybe it's not. You know, if she had been like, hey, we're, this song is for me from the jump, then great. You know, like, working with direction is always helpful, and I think that's valuable. I think, to your point, is like the underpinning of that being that, you know, walking in with good intentions about, hey, we're just looking for the best life for the song that we're making today, and we can only write the song that we're writing today. You know, sometimes it's like when you're trying too hard to write something that doesn't want to come out, you just sort of end up writing yourself into circles, and it's, you know, no one's, you get something kind of mediocre. It's better just to be like, hey, let's just chase whatever. Like, if we had listened to Common Sense on the day of writing Build-A-Bitch, we would not have got as ridiculous a song. And, you know what I mean? Like, it's because we were just like, hey, this is literally just like made us laugh. That's it. It was just like, that's really funny. And then we just kept trying to make ourselves laugh. And you know, and that's all it was.
Well, and to your point, if you know that you are going into a write that, hey, this is for so-and-so, this is for this artist, then you're going to write to his or her style. You're going to say, okay, this is typically their sound. And yes, of course, it will influence the way you go. But yeah, otherwise, we've made our point. Build-A-Bitch was released in May 2021. Tell us about your work throughout 2021, 2022 with developing, growing artists such as Benson Boone, Leah Kate, Rosie Darling, several others.
Absolutely. So where can I start? I mean, Benson is a great place to start. Benson, we got the good fortune to work with him after a very good friend, John Chen, who is at Warner Chappell, introduced us. And Benson was very early in his journey and is now, you know, one of the biggest stars in the world. And I should add, from that moment and to today, remains literally the nicest person I've ever met in my entire life. Like, just, he is my shining example for, if someone that talented can be that successful and that nice, there's no reason why everyone can't be. So we got to work with Benson and a few other developing artists. One of the catalytic things that's going to happen when you have a song that is a little bit of what I describe as a lightning bolt, you know what I mean? It's like, it creates some commotion. It's exciting, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Is there are going to be opportunities that ensue where people go, hey, like, I wonder what else they can do.
Yeah.
And that happens in any walk of life, whether you're working at T-Mobile or you're writing songs, like, mm-hmm. you know, any kind of, you know, above the board success is always going to do that kind of thing. And that was, you know, one of those examples of where we got to work with Benson and just immediately formed like an incredible friendship and an incredible working relationship. We've written lots of songs together. We had a song called come out called Let Me Go. That was actually the first song that we wrote, and I think maybe his like third session ever.
Wow.
Like,
wow.
Yeah, he went from, when I worked with him, he had maybe started singing maybe a year prior.
Mm.
And it was just, I've never met someone with such an obvious, like, I don't love the term, like, you know, star power or whatever that is, but it was immediately obvious that he was just an exceptional human in every conceivable sense of the word. And, you know, not only an incredible singer and this incredible, like, you know, talent as a performer, but also just like incredible musical instincts. Like, that song, it's like he wrote most of the melody for it in 2 seconds. Like, just sat down at the piano, played a chord, and just it came out of his mouth.
Wow.
And one of our friends, Nolan Sipe, who's also on the record, had written a poem actually in advance of the session. He was just like, hey, I've wrote this poem kind of out of nowhere, and I just, like, I don't know, it felt special to me, I don't know what it is. And sort of, I went, well, what if we took the melody and we took the poem and we put those two things together? And, like, you know, this is the magic of sessions. But yeah, so reaffirming onto your question, basically, yeah, the Build-A-Bitch opportunity opened up into a bunch of different sessions. I think you mentioned Leah Kate, Rosie Darling, who we'd actually been working with Rosie Darling for a few years before that. We had some success with her record Coping, and we've done a bunch of records with her since. And she continues to, you know, put out incredible records. I think, I guess to try and answer the question, one of the things we tried to do is to capitalize on the moment, you know, and try and get in rooms with people that we found, you know, musically interesting, exciting, mm-hmm. things that we thought we had something to say. For me in particular, I think the thing that Build-A-Bitch and Bella Porch taught me more than anything is like the power of sort of helping to develop an artist early in their career path. and how transformative that can be when you connect with one of those lightning moments.
Mm-hmm.
And in a different way than, say, if you wrote a song and sent it to, you know, I think like Justin Bieber is a great example because he's such an icon. It's like, if you write a song and send it to Justin Bieber, just on like a practical musical terms, if you write a song and send it to him and he likes it and cuts it, that's very exciting for your career. I don't think it's as dynamic as if you write, say, like my friend Jesse Fink right now had a song by Artemis that it was just like blowing up the charts. And it's like, that's really exciting for the course of his career as a writer, because he has gone from, hey, this is a writer that the industry knows, to, wow, you are like all of a sudden on this rocket ship of a hit. And so that has been an ongoing focus kind of since like Build-A-Bitch in general, of like finding artists that I think I have something to say with, that I think I can help amplify the thing that they want to do, and do my best to try and be there for those moments.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. I'm joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Los Angeles by producer, songwriter, artist, and engineer David Arkwright. On the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net, I'm going to put a link to David's online hub. From there, you will be able to access links to his Instagram and his TikTok, as well as a Spotify playlist that contains 115 songs on which David is a writer. There are also links there to some articles, as well as a link to hire David through a platform called Sound Better. Speaking of various platforms that are out there, it's been something like the last, 4 weeks now that I've been inviting you to give me feedback on a particular episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, or just the show itself overall, through a site called Featured Up. There is no cost for you to use it, and it enables you to either write a message that will get sent directly to me, or you can instead record up to 60 seconds of audio right there on their site for me. Regardless of where / what you're listening to my conversation with David Arkwright through, in the description for this episode, you will see a direct link to that. However, I have also put a Featured Up logo on my podcast website, nhte.net. If you're in the habit of going there and want to just tap or click on that logo instead to go over to my page on their site to send me questions, comments, suggestions, whatever feedback you have on this or any episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. David, you were talking about 2021, 2022, more present day. Let's shift over and have you tell us about your more recent work with international artists, K-pop, J-pop, Latin, work you've done in India.
Absolutely. Where to start? there's so much. So recently I've been spending a lot of time working with Indian artists, Indian collaborators, by virtue of some of my closest collaborators, Miranda Glory and Natanya Lalwani. Natanya is from India. Early last year, she was going to India, and she had invited Miranda and myself to come with her as sort of like, hey, let's just like go on a vacation. And I was reluctant, but I was like, okay, you know, that could be fun. And so I had planned a trip for 2 weeks.
Mm.
And right before we sort of left for that trip, Natanya had an opportunity from a Warner Music A&R connect, Abhishek, who is sort of the head of A&R at Warner India. And he had this song from this artist King named Manmeri John, and they had an original sort of Hindi version, and they were looking for a more like sort of a blended American pop Indian rework of the song, and to potentially add an English section and to potentially get a feature. That's how it was presented to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sat down, and again, it was like one of those things that just came out really quickly. Like King is, I would come to know later, and I'll explain the story momentarily, I would come to know later, is this incredible like writing talent, like a star of his own right. And so like the melodies and everything were all there, and we adapted some of them and made some changes and that sort of thing in order to better accommodate an English lyric, reworked some English lyrics, and I flipped the production to what I felt was a more American-infused pop-focused record.
Mm-hmm.
While trying to maintain a lot of the Indian identity, which is very important to me, is trying to balance those two things. And so we sent that over, and rave reviews. You know, they just, the team loved it. It was great. And it literally so happened that the next week we were going to India. And so the A&R suggests, he's like, well, while you're here, why don't you just get a day with King? You know, he'd love to meet you. Like, he really loved what you did. Mm. It was great. And so we set up a session, and I've told the story to a few friends a couple times, but basically, like, how that session went is we show up on the day of the session, and already India is, like, you know, an insane, total cultural shock, like, just a wild experience. So I'm already sort of all over the place. And we show up, and we got there about an hour before him, and I started to sort of make a bit of a beat for a song that has yet to come out, but hopefully will. And we started to write, you know, a couple melodies here and there, and he walked through the door and just immediately, like, caught the vibe, started singing. Mm. And so I went, oh, scrambled and turned on an SM7 that we just had, like, lying around and handed it to him, and he started recording. And I'm not kidding. We went an hour straight of just making the song. Wow. And, like, basically wrote the entire song before we ever said hello.
Wow.
So, like, we got through the entire record, and not in its entirety, but, like, you know, the yeah. skeleton of it. Yeah. And then if I was like, hey, nice to meet you, I'm Dave. And so we immediately recognized that, you know, sort of myself, Natanya, Miranda, and King had this really great writing chemistry. Just sort of immediately it made sense. And so from there on out, basically the A&R at the end of the day came back and was like, hey, what if, you know, would you be willing to just, he wants to do a whole album with you. Mm. Like, he's been looking to do a whole album. He's been waiting for this moment. He thinks you're the right guy. Like, can we just do that? And I was like, yeah, but I don't think I can do it. Like, I'm here for vacation. And they're like, well, could you just extend your trip? So I just extended my trip to a month, which was wildly unexpected. I lived in India for a month, apparently. And we just smashed through, you know, the skeleton of the album. And then I subsequently took it home, and we did several versions. And I had gone back to India. Once we had done that, it sort of cemented, I think, our name got around a little bit in India, because King is, you know, very successful there. Mm. And so we got some other invites from artists like Dwani and a couple other people, and I could get lost in the weeds of it all. But anyways, I had to go back to India throughout the course of last year a couple of times, and every time I go back, we would work on the album a little bit. And then, yeah, we finished it up, and that was sort of it. And that was my big induction into Indian music and the process of how they make that. And, you know, I think the thing I'd say about working internationally for myself, and this is not something that I recommend as necessarily advice, but I would just say is, if you're out there wanting to work with me on international, non-American-focused pop music, is I sort of operate from the perspective of, like, I'm trying to figure out a way to infuse both things. If you want to write a really classic, you know, if they had wanted to make a whole really classic Hindi album in a way that was super culturally authentic,
yeah,
I would have said, with respect, like, I'm not the person.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of, you know, whether it's K-pop or J-pop or working on Latin music, I'm always kind of walking into it just saying, like, hey, I make the thing that I make, and I want to, like, infuse your cultural elements into it, but I don't want to be robbing from that culture, and I also don't want to be pretending like I'm trying to do something that I'm like, you would, if you want to make a reggaeton record and exclusively make a reggaeton record that has no part of my influence, then you should be working with someone who is steeped in that culture and that industry. And that's sort of been the backbone of my working with various different cultures around the world, is like, I'm here to meet you halfway, and I hope you're here to meet me halfway. And that's sort of been my working thesis on all of these various different cultural projects.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you clarified that, because I had kind of wondered, looking at your body of work, you know, is David, does he get to the point where he draws the line somewhere, though, meaning there's just some styles of music where you will turn away work simply because, that's just not my thing, you know, meaning you haven't worked in that genre, or you just personally don't like that kind of music. And so you have to politely, professionally turn people away who are wanting to hire you to do that with them because it's not your thing.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's like, I'm always willing to try. Like, certainly it's like, I always want to show up and I always want to give it a shot. If it feels too obtuse for me, if it feels like I'm not a right fit, as early as possible, I would bow out or decline or pass it to someone who needs to be there. And I would say that's pretty rare. Like, for the most point, I think you know, as different as our cultural expectations of music are, I think the bones of most of it, especially in terms of just like, hey, whether it's Hindi pop music or whether it's K-pop or J-pop or Latin pop or whatever it is, it's like the bones of it are very similar. Like there's mm-hmm. a expectation around structure and yeah. and sort of like chorus diverse relationships and things like that. I mean, like all those rules are translatory. And so it's pretty rare, but it does happen. There are times when I get handed a project and I go, hey, you know, like this, especially when we're talking about like languages that I don't understand, it can add to a level of complexity because of course, like, if it's really complicated rhythmically or things like that, I don't want to be like, you know, making what I feel is a good artistic edit and then I'm chopping a sentence in half by accident. And you know, things like it's trying to be respectful of the fact that like there are moments when having a cultural fusion is absolutely the right thing for that artist. And there are moments when they need to be working with someone who is deeply steeped in that culture and That's is the right person. And sometimes that requires, you know, sometimes we'll bring in people for that. And other times, like, it doesn't need it. With a lot of the India stuff, fortunately, it's like we've had a really good run of sort of balancing those expectations. But I also have Netanya Lawani sort of on my side with all of that. And she is like this, you know, she's lived in the States for 7 or 8 years, but grew up in Mumbai. And so is this incredible cultural translator in terms of like, sometimes in terms of really specific things, like they want the drums to feel bigger. And she's like, I think what they just mean is louder. And you're like, oh, okay. Turn up the drum bus a dB. And everyone goes, oh, you know what I mean? Like it's sometimes it's really simple thing.
He's brilliant. Yes. This is why we got David.
Yes, exactly. Sometimes it's really simple things like that. Other times it's more complex. But you know, ultimately it's like, I try and have this expectation of like, hey, like I'm kind of here to do my thing and to uplift what my version of your voice is in the way I feel like sort of a traditional producer is viewed. Like you could look at like a Rick Rubin or something like that, where it's like, I'm not out here setting studio rules and going that far, but I'm trying to bring my perspective as well without overshadowing your own.
Yep.
But I still have something to say, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Nicely said. Let's shift gears and dive into the current state of the music industry. Back on episode 525, my guest was Nashville songwriter Blue Foley, who disclosed that while he had 23 singles in the last year alone, on the financial side, you would never know it. He said that he had nothing to show for all that monetarily, and as a result, he was talking about some big changes going forward. David, I would love to hear your insights on the changing nature of the songwriter business model.
Yeah. Oh, it is so meaningfully different from how it... Like, I think we sort of operate on generationally, like, 10 to 15-year cycles of where the industry sort of is at. And we are so far past the, you know, the point of, like, the 80s, early 90s of, like, you know, millions of record sales and incredible mechanical royalties. For those people who don't know, mechanical royalties are the royalties paid to songwriters on the physical sales of record distribution. And the way those work today is because most of record consumption, certainly in North America and in Europe, is streaming, those mechanicals are, by percentage, just a lot lower than they used to be. And, you know, the industry is fighting harder to try and bring those things up. But what it has required for the working songwriter to do is to, A, look into markets that are still producing really well in physical. So outside of my own incredible cultural interest in J-pop and K-pop, one of, you know, if I'm just being a practical business person, which I think mm-hmm. is inherently important in being a working musician, those are markets in which they still sell incredible volumes of physical records and there's still mechanical sales to be made. And so just on the pure songwriting path, it's, I think that's very important to look at those types of things. And then also, you know, we see the growing movement on social media and amidst conversations I have with colleagues, which is, you know, songwriters asking for fees from artists and or major labels as they're releasing records or points of the master, because the overwhelming distribution of streaming royalties are part of the master royalty instead of the mechanical or publishing royalty. And as we've come to understand it, you know, the Hot 100 used to be an incredible barometer for how much publishing money you were going to make as a songwriter. And unfortunately, it's not the same as it used to be because now it's so powered by streaming. It used to be like if you were at the top of the Hot 100, there would be a really good chance you're going to make a lot of money. And that expectation has changed. Now, certainly there are records that are cultural juggernauts. I think of Benson Boone's recent record, Million Dollar Baby. There's other, you know, other various artists and their songs that have done super, super well and get an incredible amount of radio play. And those shouldn't be discounted. But the number of songs that are actively going to radio are fewer and further between as far as working songwriters' ability to get it there. And so, you know, both in my own business and what I encourage for other people is to try and stretch out into other areas. Like, Sync is an incredible place to be a part of. Mm-hmm. You know, things like trying to work on projects where you do have master's ownership and trying to negotiate those things for yourselves, trying to be a part of markets that do have some mechanical royalty. And also, like, the interesting thing is, like, I talk about all the work I do in India, and they're very early in all of these aspects. Like, they don't have a system for master's royalties, generally speaking. They are just starting to introduce publishing royalties, like, in the last couple of years. Like, it's all pretty new for them. And the thing is, like, but I also believe so fervently in the ability for India to take off as this global market. And so it's also taking big bets. It's going, hey, how can I do some things that are very practical, and also how can I do some things that are on their face not particularly practical, but if it goes well, could be a cultural and dynamic global shift. And I try and balance my career and encourage others to balance their careers in the same way, which is like have a little, you know, it's like trading in the stock market, which I do not do and would be terrible at. But that same idea of, you know, not putting all your eggs in one basket, diversifying yourself, having some element of hedging, if you will, I think exists in the working quality of a songwriter. I also have, you know, a really important aphorism that I level to other writers and musicians, which is like surviving is the first part. I think sometimes we get so caught up in what kind of music do I want to be making and how do I want to be viewed, we forget that, like, well, if you can't pay rent, you can't really make music, you know? So surviving is really like your base level. Like, let's figure that out. And while you're doing that, take 20% of your time and work on the things that you want to be working on. And what you're going to find is that over a career's worth of time, like now if I look at my career, the overwhelming distribution of the thing I'm working on are things that I choose to be working on, where they're presented to me and I like it and I think I have something to say, and they're not necessarily I'm doing it just exclusively for a paycheck or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's being mindful of those two things. And, you know, as a songwriter, it's a scary world. It's sort of like getting your license in 2024 and saying, hey, I think I want to open a taxi company. It's like, well, you can, but there is Uber out there, and you got to be aware of that. And so, you know, just walking into it, really acknowledging what the world is and also hoping for the change that you want to see.
Yeah, that's great advice. And as much as I chuckled a little bit, it is very much the reality that you are looking a little too far down the road and you got to look at the absolute basics first. So you can't lose sight of that, because in this business, it can be very tempting to get caught up and get excited and start spending the money that you don't have or start celebrating the cut that you haven't even gotten yet, that type of thing. Last week on the show, we heard Mike Avename talk about the studio he built in L.A., in part out of necessity because he had gotten injured and as a drummer was going to be off the road for at least a year. And David, I would love to hear your perspective on engineering as a producer, building a studio, gear partnerships, and the merging of the roles in today's landscape.
Absolutely. So, you know, to me, I am a very, at least in my head, an engineer first producer, if that makes sense. So it's wanting to capture the best possible performance. I really try and make my productions shine through my best version of a compelling rough mix. No, I'm not saying that that's the greatest mix of all time, but it is the way in which I think, you know, oftentimes what I've realized over the course of my career is that early in your career as a producer, you think, hey, this doesn't feel big enough because I haven't added enough. And in truth, often it's because you haven't sculpted it or you haven't captured it in a way that you are capable of doing that. So in particular, like, depending on how the audio is edited, I'm also capturing this through my Hazelrig gear, my Hazelrig VLC. I'm a huge fan of the Hazelrig products, you know, not to plug too hard, but just like that's my genuine feeling is that it's like, it's all tube love. Like I love analog gear. I love
what gets you to that place. I'm a huge passionate advocate for, you know, quality monitoring, finding what works best for you in terms of monitoring, in terms of room treatment, trying to prioritize all of those things first. Mm. You know, if I was going to give advice to a burgeoning songwriter or producer, it's like, you know, the first things I would tell you to invest in other than your computer are going to be a compelling vocal chain, room treatment, and room treatment first, you know, is making sure that your space is treated in such a way that you can hear what you're trying to hear. Because despite the fact that there are an incredible number of producers who have made hits, you know, working in the corner on some, you know, really junk monitors or like, you know, $20 headphones or whatever, it's that is the much harder road. And I think it's like you have to be a real phenomenon to be able to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's just sort of how I think about it. And that's my perspective on trying to, you know, I want to try and capture a really incredible performance from the singer or from the artist or the instrumentalist or whatever that is. And I want to have the tools around me to be able to do that. Now, of course, that isn't always, you know, I've been fortunate to do well in my career to a point where I've invested heavily back into my music. But the case is like making that a priority is really important. It's always been really fascinating to me to see, you know, one of the virtues of being able to work with a great diversity of people is seeing really incredibly successful musicians and artists still working on like the worst setup imaginable. and because I think it's some level of comfort, you know, some level of comfort, and it's some level of apathy or whatever that happens to be. And in my brain, I just sort of always go like, this is your job. Like, this is your career. Like, we don't like, I take this super seriously. And that is not to say that I am right by any means, but I am going to pursue the path that I think is correct. And I hope for everyone else to sort of do the same without obviously putting themselves into financial burden.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's not unlike, I just did a speaking engagement where I was telling people about podcasting. And one of the things that I mentioned is the actual recording process. And I told them, admittedly, I am an audio snob, folks. So if I was to tell you what you really should go out and buy, you would never start a podcast. So if yes. It's, okay, all I have is my phone, I'm going to be really uncomfortable with that, but at least it gets you started. And I told them, unless you're an totally. A-lister, you're not going to have a worldwide audience of 1 million listeners when episode one comes out anyways. So I'd rather see you get started. But yes, ultimately, I'm very much a huge advocate for pro audio and for doing everything you can. I loved that you talked about treating the room. And obviously, when you can make the investment to the level of something like Hazelrig gear, you want to make sure that, like you said, if this is your profession, this is your digital business card. This is the first impression you're going to make on someone you're not going to meet in person. They're going to hear something that you put out as a recording, and they're going to say, this person does good work, and it's going to be based on a number of things contained within that recording. So you and I could probably talk all day about the importance of audio
quality.
Yeah,
I could nerd out really hard.
Yeah. We're going to close today with the song that David talked about earlier by King and Nick Jonas called Mon Mary John. David was a writer on it, produced it, was the mix engineer for it. Before I let you go, though, David, and I play that track, just talk a little bit more about this one, if you would, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was one of those records where it was really interesting. This was where my friend Natanya came in absolute clutches. Not only was she the one who connected the record in general on almost like an A&R side of things, but also she was very helpful in translating the Hindi and then us, because we were trying to make an American version of it. And ultimately, we were trying to make, you know, a compelling English version around a similar melody that carried a similar lyrical sentiment. But obviously, like, as you can imagine, with any, you know, put any two languages into Google Translate and the result is not going to be accurate. So that was our first, like, really big challenge. And then the secondary challenge was, of course, on the mix process. Myself and another mix engineer friend of mine, Michael Freeman, did it together. And the reason why, honestly, is because normally it's like I pass most of my productions off to a mix engineer like himself or my friend Yanni AP or various other people that I work with, depending on the style of music. And what had happened was we had turned in a version and then they needed a bunch of changes, and it was like 4 o'clock in the morning because it was India there. And so I jumped in and had to make a bunch of changes mix-wise, and we had to go back to the rough. And, you know, it was one of those things where it's like we made a myriad of different changes and versions on it. And so I, for one of the very few times, was credited as a co-mixer, and that's how that came about. But, you know, and just from a production perspective, it was really just they gave me all the stems to the original record, and I sorted through and, you know, went, okay, how can I add an American pop perspective to this, and how can I keep the identity? A lot of the identity I felt was in is in the strings and in some of the Indian harmonic instrumentation, and then a lot of what we flipped around was like the bass and the drums, which I feel are sort of like the fundamental nature of American pop music lives in the bass and the drums, and that's how we sort of blended the cultural identity of both things.
Yeah, and I want to read the mind of the audience right now, because I have a feeling there's going to be people who are going to say, well, if Nick Jonas is on it, doesn't just having an American artist like him, doesn't that help Americanize it? And I think it's kind of one of those, well, yes, that's one of the ingredients, but you don't just get an American artist and say, there, now it has an American feel to it.
Yes. And definitely, I've totally ignored the Nick Jonas component. Nick was so gracious to hop on it, and of course has an incredible cultural connection to India through his wife. And so he was just like such an exciting, we were so happy when we got him. I remember like we were like, yeah, like just like full freak out excitement that he was jumping on, because he was like, he was our dream ask from the beginning. Like I had sang the original demo, and so, you know, there was my very mediocre version, then he hopped on and transforms the whole thing. It was great. But yeah, it's like, yes, absolutely, he brings certainly an American pop perspective, but also it's, you know, and I encourage the audience like to go compare and contrast the original with the, you know, the Afterlife version, and look at the differences in terms of where they're at.
Okay.
And, you know, like I could say one's better than the other. I don't think that, because like the Hindi version has outstreamed my version 10-1. but they're just very different things for very different audiences. And, you know, this is a great sort of end point on my working on cultural projects and trying to meld two things together, is like I'm trying to create these cultural bridges where I can proliferate the beauty of, say, Indian music or Korean music or Japanese music, and give it to a global audience that's maybe more used to an American pop perspective, and try and introduce it in a way that they can dive deeper and they can go back and hear the original version and find something that they love.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, that's kind of the idea.
I like that. I like that. And just one final housekeeping note here. Nick Jonas, did he come to India and record? Did you record him in Los Angeles? Did somebody record him in New York? How was that part done?
I didn't record him.
Okay.
I believe he actually recorded it at two separate locations. I think once in New York and maybe once in London. And I'm not totally certain. I think one of them might have been in a hotel room.
Wow.
I'm just trying to remember vaguely, because it happened over a little bit of time. So it's like he did a version and then we wanted some edits and he wanted some lyrical changes. It was like one of those things where we went back and forth a couple of times until we got the vocal the way everyone was happy with it. But yeah, no, I was not the engineer for his vocal.
And audience, don't overlook what David just said. I think it might have been in a hotel room. That is where audio equipment has come to nowadays, with portable units that do allow someone like a Nick Jonas or someone like yourself, the person who's listening to this interview, to get great pro quality audio in a place like a hotel room. David, so wonderful to have you on the show today. Great to meet you. Thank you for making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure. With that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to producer, songwriter, artist, and engineer David Arkwright. As I mentioned earlier, on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net, I will have a link to David's online hub. From there, you will be able to access links to his Instagram and his TikTok, as well as a Spotify playlist that currently contains 115 songs on which David is a writer. There are also links there to some articles, as well as a link to hire David through a platform called Sound Better. This morning, I followed David on Instagram, and I'm sure he would appreciate you doing the same, and with TikTok as well. For that matter, tell David that you heard him on Now Hear This Entertainment. I do truly hope that you like this show, that you're enjoying what I'm doing every week on the Now Hear This Entertainment podcast. If you've made it all the way to the end, thank you for having stuck with David and I, and I'm going to assume that that means that you do like the podcast. You can take action to let me know that you appreciate the work that I do to keep making this show happen every week, every month, more than 10 years without missing once, by going on my podcast website, nhte.net, and then using the yellow Buy Me a Coffee logo that you will see there. This is not a sponsor. It's not affiliated with any brand or chain. It's just a fun way for you to send your support, your thanks to me, including a note that I will see when you utilize that option. You can also just head directly to buymeacoffee.com/BruceW. That's going to do it for episode 539. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'll send you out today with another song that David was a writer on, produced, and was the mix engineer on. As performed by King and Nick Jonas, this is the one he just talked about. It's called Mon Mary John.
मैं तेरी आँखों में उदासी कभी देख सकता नहीं तुझे खुश मैं रखूँगा सुने आ मैं तेरे होंठों पे खामोशी कभी देख सकता नहीं सारी बातें मैं सुनूँगा सुने आ Don't let the sun come up if I can't live with your love Don't go when the night's still young I need you near मेरी जान तूने मुझको पागल है किया मेरा लगदा ना जिया तेरे बगैर Yeah, this is how it starts Your body in my arms Running right through my veins All the way up to my heart
तू मान मेरी जान मैं तुझे जाने ना दूंगा मैं तुझको अपनी आंखों में बसा के
It's desert, just to dry a tear from your eyes. I would say no to the gates of heaven if it meant I left you behind. Every touch is a sweet surrender. Every moment with you a treasure. When we put in our lips together, I know I could hold you forever, ever, ever.
मेरी बाहों में आके तू जाना नहीं ऐसी रब से मैं मांगू दुआ मेरी जान तूने मुझको पागल है किया मेरा लगदा ना जिया तेरे बगैर
तुम माने मेरी जान क्यों पारी इन माय आर्म्स रनिंग राइट थ्रू माय वेंस ऑल द वे अप टू माय हार्ट
तू मान मेरी जान मैं तुझे जाने ना दूंगा मैं तुझको अपनी आंखों में बसा के